We take up our study of Bunyan's blessed allegory, The Holy War. We take it up here in the paragraph that begins these words, the name of the mayor that was of Diabolus' making was the Lord Lusting, etc. But I read for your hearing and to capture the context, I read the previous paragraph where he said, but now he, having disabled the Lord Mayor and Recorder from bearing of office in Mansoul, and seeing that the town, before he came to it, was the most ancient of corporations in the world, and fearing, if he did not maintain greatness, they at any time should object that he had done them an injury. Therefore I say, that they might see that he did not intend to lessen their grandeur, or to take from them any of their advantageous things, he did choose for them a Lord Mayor and a Recorder himself, and such as contented them at the heart, and such also as pleased him wondrously well. And so in the paragraph before us today, the next paragraph, Bunyan sets about to tell us who these persons are that he has handpicked to fill these positions. The name of the mayor that was of Diabolus' making was Lord Lusting. And I've noticed some of you have already flipped the page and looked, but there is an incredible graphic in our copy of this Lord Lusting. And of course, he's sitting on a giant throne with a great big fat belly. He's overindulged, of course. His feet are on the book of the law. And above his head and on his throne is engraved the word license. Lord Lusting. What a beautiful graphic portrayal of this Lord Lusting. The mayor, the name of the mayor that was of Diabolus' making was Lord Lusting. A man that had neither eyes nor ears. All that he did, whether as a man or as an officer, he did it naturally, as does the beast. I was preaching in the jail this morning, and actually, before I even started preaching, I don't remember how exactly someone said something, and we were just really having a conversation before I actually started the service, and I had a most enlightening experience talking with the men about the difference between men and animals, and how that animals don't think. I know as people we ascribe thought to them. We you know, if you go away for a week, you come back and your dog's wagging his tail like mad, and you say, "Oh, did you miss me?" Animals just don't have thought processes. They don't have the ability of self-evaluation. I said to the men in jail this morning, a bird never sits on a limb on a beautiful day and looks up at the sky and looks at the beautiful white clouds floating by and thinks, "Oh, I'd love to paint that. I wish I could paint that." Birds don't have those kind of thoughts. They're animals. They're birds. Now, I know in Hans Christian Andersen and others, we ascribe human attributes to animals, do we not, to tell stories. But they're not human, and they don't have reasoning ability. And what I said to the men was, the difference is man has the capacity, because of the image of God, to reason and think about a thing. That's how we got to talking about it. I was talking to them about the importance of using their time there to think, because when they're on the outside, they don't think. And I was talking about that we have a whole generation who is thoughtless. They do not think. In fact, the difference between man and animal is animals simply respond to the stimuli in their environment. They're just responding to the environment. And I said, unfortunately, we have come to an entire generation of humans who have become animalistic, and they no longer think. They are purely responding to their environment. And I was in the red suits. I had complete agreement. Everybody's shaking their head. I said, these computer games, for example. You see kids walking, and I said, it's not like playing chess where you think about a strategy and you incorporate a strategy and a scheme and you plan. No, it's not that. These games are nothing but you're just sitting here responding to something that's moving. It's totally animalistic. There is no thought process in it. And we have a whole generation like that. And Bunyan describes Lord Lusting as a man that hath neither eyes nor ears. All he did, he said, whether as a man or as an officer, he did it naturally as doth the beast. He's just an animal. He's just responding to he's giving license to his animal instincts. And that's all. That's literally all that he's doing. Mason, in his commentary on the Holy War, said, a shocking but true picture of every man by the fall. A compound of devilish and beastly lusts and appetites. If we look around, says Mason, we may see that irregular aims and desires deluge the world. Most men have no higher object or pursuit than the narrow limits of this vain, perishing world, and are therefore led captive by Satan at his will. Thus it will be till sovereign grace effects a change. Thus it will be till sovereign grace effects a change. For at that happy period, a new world arises in the regenerate soul. But they who live and die slaves to their lusts and passions must perish everlastingly. So the scripture says, if ye live after the flesh, ye shall die. Lord Lusting. Murder said, instead of understanding, which before the revolution governed the town, Mr. Lusting is made Lord Mayor. And this wretch had neither eyes nor ears, so beastly are carnal lusts that they pay no regard to reason nor danger, but are hurried on by mere appetite to every fleshly indulgence. So now, here in this most ancient of all corporations, don't forget it, here in man's soul, that most ancient of all corporations, the new Lord Mayor is Lord Lusting. That which made him, Bunyan says, and that which made him yet more ignoble, though not to man's soul, yet to them that beheld and were grieved for its ruins, was that he never could favor good but evil. Now, I tell you, dear old Bunyan, in this portrayal of the destruction and downfall of man's soul, he just keeps driving us back to that doctrine of total depravity. He just keeps going back and beating this horse and beating this horse, beating this horse of total depravity. Bunyan says the worst part, the most ignoble thing about this man, this Lord Lusting, the most grievous of all, is that he never could favor good. He couldn't do it. He couldn't do it. Now, so he replaced Lord Lusting, Lord the mayor, with Lord Lusting. And then in the next paragraph, the recorder whom Diabolus chose, whose name was Forget Good, and a very sorry fellow he was. Now, you recognize, I hope, the irony here, the play and the irony that Bunyan has introduced. Such is the genius of the Tinker from Bedford. Because what could be more paradoxical than this? His office is to record, but his name is to forget. The recorder is Mr. Forget Good. So, apparently, he isn't going to record a lot of things, is he? He's not going to record anything good. What an irony. So Bunyan says the new recorder's name, he's going to be a fellow named Forget Good. He could remember nothing but mischief, and to do it with delight. And yet, he's the recorder. Well, Mason in his commentary said, ever since the fall, the memory is become so depraved that it naturally retains evil, but it lets slip that which is good. And the imagination is more apt to be taken with the former than the latter. Be it therefore our daily prayer for a sanctified memory to retain divine things, and that we may grow up in the knowledge and belief and love of the truth. Do we not find it so, all of us, that we have to retain, we have to work to retain good knowledge? But we pick up evil almost thoughtlessly. We can just hear something and boom, it sticks with us if it's evil. Just sticks with us. Can't even seem to wash it out. But if we try to learn something good, we just struggle with it. Well, that's because Diabolus has brought a new recorder to our man's soul, and his name is Forget Good. He was naturally prone to do things that were hurtful, even hurtful to the town of Mansoul and all the dwellers there. These two, that is, Lord Lusting and Forget Good, these two, therefore, by their power and practice, examples and smiles upon evil, did much more grammar and settle the common people in hurtful ways. Now, there's your wonderful, children, there's your wonderful word. We normally think of the word grammar as a noun, don't we? Here is the word grammar used as a verb. What a wonderful word that is. Here's the word grammar. He says that these two fellows, they did much more grammar and settle the common people in hurtful ways. I actually looked that up in the old dictionary to see, and it was in fact used as a verb. I had not run across that before, but outside of Bunyan's writings. For who doth not perceive that when those that sit aloft are vile and corrupt themselves, they corrupt the whole region and country where they are. Well, again, the commentator in our own book that we have of study, he says that for the full construction of Satan's kingdom, there must needs be the utter destruction of Shaddai's sovereignty and all things appertaining thereto, his image, etc. The first note on page 25 of our book. When the affections serve the carnal will, they are perverted into vile affections, and under such direction the emotions of the soul become the promptings of evil, nor do they abide alone, but they become prolific and accursed progeny. When affection is wedded to lust, the offspring will be a diabolian brood, and we read that to you last week. We already covered that subject. But I'll share with you a note from Mason again. I appreciate John finding me these volumes of different men's commentaries on Bunyan's writings. Try to give you the 1784. I'm sorry. Right, the original writings of Mason was 1784. And Mason made this comment: when Satan has obtained full possession of the heart, he gradually draws it off from the observance of those duties we owe to God and man as reasonable creatures, such as ordinances, public and private prayer, obedience and affection to parents and relatives. Also from that important duty essential to the welfare of our immortal spirits, self-examination. These being neglected, the sinner becomes at length, by evil courses, a very good work reprobate. 1 Timothy 1:16. May the Lord stir us up to use the means of grace, that we may not thus make shipwreck of faith and of good conscience. We are indeed. The Proverbs 29 verse 2, 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 6, 1 Corinthians 15 and 33 tell us this very fact, that they corrupt themselves. These two bring to the heart of man's soul that which will cause us to corrupt ourselves and the whole region around us. And then Bunyan says, beside these, Diabolus made several burgesses and aldermen in man's soul, such as out of whom the town, when it needed, might choose them officers, governors, and magistrates. And these are the names of the chief of them. Now, these are other men whom Diabolus has sanctioned to be used by the people of man's soul as they saw fit. Mr. Incredulity, Mr. Hardy, Mr. Swearing, Mr. Whoring, Mr. Hardheart, Mr. Pitiless, Mr. Fury, Mr. No Truth, Mr. Stand to Lies, Mr. False Peace, Mr. Drunkenness, Mr. Cheating, Mr. Atheism, 13 in all. Mr. Incredulity is the eldest, and Mr. Atheist is the youngest. Now, that's an interesting historical note, and I won't spend a lot of time here with it today because ours is more of a general study. But it is of a great deal of interest that in Bunyan's day and in his mind, he ranked Mr. Incredulity as the eldest and Mr. Atheism as the youngest of these 13. We'll not go there, but that's an interesting study. There was, says Bunyan, also an election of common councilmen and others as bailiffs, sergeants, constables, and others, But all of them, like to those aforenamed, being either fathers, brothers, cousins, or nephews, to them whose names, for brevity's sake, I omit to mention. Now, where do you think? It's a thought question, but it really doesn't require a lot of thought. Where do you think Bunyan got all these things? When he was penning these words, where do you think he got all these thoughts? Well, I might suggest he knew them in his own heart. He knew them to be residents in his own man's soul. Drunkenness, cheating, lying, atheism, fury, swearing, whoring. These were people Bunyan knew. And in fact, if you look in your heart and I look in mine, we'll find a good number of these residents. I wouldn't have to look far to come up with them. Bunyan did. And then he says, when the giant had thus far proceeded in his work, in the next place, he betook him to build some strongholds in the town, and he built three that seemed to be impregnable. Now, Bunyan is going to tell us three impregnable strongholds Satan built, Diabolus built. The first he called the Hold of Defiance, because it was made to command the whole town and to keep it from the knowledge of its ancient king. Now, this one commanded the whole town. And moms and dads, don't we see this in those little man souls? I mean, right from the beginning, defiance. Right from the beginning. As soon as you start imposing your will and interrupting theirs, just that soon you'll find defiance. It's born there. Born in the town of Mansoul. This is the first hold of defense that Diabolus has in man's soul. The second he called Midnight Hold, because it was built on purpose to keep man's soul from the true knowledge of itself. In other words, darkness. Darkness. Midnight. The third was called Sweet Sin Hold, because by that he fortified man's soul against all desires of good. In other words, he's going to make sin sweet to the soul. But we know it isn't, don't we? We know by regeneration and from the scriptures, we know that it isn't sweet. But we don't know that naturally, do we? When we are in the grips of Diabolus, we don't know that sin is not sweet. We think it is sweet. And so this is one of the great strongholds that Diabolus has in man's soul. The third was called Sweet Sin Hold, because by that he fortified man's soul against all desires of good. The first of these holds, that is, the Hold of Defiance, stood close by ear gate, that as much as might be, light might be darkened there. The second was built hard by the old castle, to the end that that might be made more blind if possible. And the third stood in the marketplace. By the way, Sweet Sin, that's the third one. Sweet Sin, notice again, notice the genius of Bunyan. He marks this third one, Sweet Sin, as being close to the marketplace. Isn't it always true that sweet sin is always prolific in a marketplace? Isn't it true that a marketplace just supplies a good atmosphere for sin to be made to appear sweet? You see the genius of that? See the genius of Bunyan? Sweet sin, he says, is sitting very close to the marketplace. Mason said in his commentary, "Thus Satan fixes his empire in the soul. Number one, by means of its enmity and aversion to divine instruction. Number two, by the blindness of the understanding and perverseness of the will, whereby the knowledge of its lamentable state and of God can be concealed. And thirdly, by habit and delight in sin, rolling it as a sweet morsel under the tongue, all which, if grace prevent not, drown men in destruction and perdition." Wow. So there's three strongholds and there's three governors. There's a stronghold of defiance. And well, let's just read the next paragraph first. "He that Diabolus made governor over the first of these was one Spike God," that is the governor over the hold of defiance. "A most blasphemous wretch he came with the whole rabble of them that came against man's soul at first, and was himself one of themselves. He that was made the governor of the midnight hole was one loved no light. He was also of them that came first against the town. And he that was made the governor of the hole called Sweet Sin Hole was one whose name was Love Flesh. He was also a very lewd fellow, but not of that country where the other are bound. This fellow could find more sweetness when he stood sucking of a lust than he did in all the paradise of God." What a statement that is. That is a huge statement. Man's lust, our lust, can find more sweetness sucking from a lust than we found in the whole paradise of God. So there's three strongholds and three governors. Defiance, whose governor is Spite God. Midnight, whose governor is Love No Light. And Sweet Sin, whose governor is Love Flesh. My goodness, what a mess. What a mess. The last paragraph of this chapter, "And now Diabolus thought himself safe. He had taken man's soul. He had engarrisoned himself therein. He had put down the old officers, had set up new ones. He had defaced the image of Shaddai and had set up his own. He had spoiled the old law books and had promoted his own vain lies. He had made new magistrates and set up new aldermen. He had builded him new holes and had manned them for himself. And all this he did to make himself secure in case the good Shaddai or his son should come to make an incursion upon him." Notice the last word of that sentence. Him. This was never about man's soul. This was about Diabolus. This is what Diabolus wanted. And you remember earlier in this chapter, he made that point to us that this was man's soul, this ancient corporation, was made for the king's son. This was for the king's son. It was made for that. And Diabolus wanted to destroy it and possess it for that reason, so that he might strike at the king's son. This was never about the object of man's soul per se. It was about man's soul as it might be an instrument in the hand of Diabolus to strike at the king's son. I hope you understand that. Bunyan's very clear, and this he did. He said he fortified himself lest Shaddai or his son should come to make an incursion upon him. Wow, what a picture. What a terrible, desperate picture this is. Any question or comments or further enlightenment on this chapter?